Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. James Hogue brings 30 years in journalism to his role as editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and to his membership on the board of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. In the 1960s, Hogue was a Washington correspondent, covering Congress, national politics, and international assignments. In the 1970s and 80s, he was editor and publisher of newspapers in Chicago and New York City, which between the two won a total of 7 Pulitzer Prizes under his direction. For the Institute's inaugural lecture, Hogue chose for a topic the changing nature of the relationship between the United States and the nations of Europe. Following his remarks, we'll hear a response from university professor and professor of history, David Fromkin. Here now is James Hogue.
Over the last half century, the transatlantic relationship has been shaken a number of times by crises, and a few of them were serious enough to raise questions about the viability of the relationship and of its institutions. But every serious breach was overcome throughout the Cold War, in part because of the Soviet threat, which was always there, and the West's will to maintain deterrence. Well, once again, I'd say the relationship is quite frayed. This time there is no external threat to Europe. International terrorism can be considered a replacement worry, particularly by those of us here, I think. But it is not geographically defined, nor do the Atlantic partners view it with equal alarm. A shocked America began gearing up right away for battle after the terrorist attacks of 14 months ago on New York and Washington. The United States struck quickly and sharply against al-Qaeda. It is now threatening Iraq, and it has had smaller targets to hit in between, and maybe more to come. Now, while offering some assistance, Europe has not experienced a similar sense of urgency. This past summer, an essay circulated very widely both on this side of the Atlantic and the other. It boldly predicted a parting of the ways for the Atlantic partners. Robert Kagan of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace wrote that Europe and America were drifting apart and no longer shared a common worldview. Kagan depicted Europe as preoccupied with its own zone of peace, wherein negotiations and mediation are expected to resolve differences and international law to sustain order. Kagan found Europe's pacifism, his word for it, a natural outgrowth of its relative powerlessness. On the other hand, the United States is more ready to employ force to preserve security and promote a liberal order in the dangerous world outside Europe. Kagan ascribes this to the United States' dominant military and economic power and its global reach. Some commentators have stepped up, particularly in the neoconservative camp, to concur that the transatlantic relationship is going to count for far less as the partners go increasingly separate ways. But I find the Kagan view of a Kantian Europe in juxtaposition to a Hobbesian United States overdrawn. It seems to me each can claim a bit of both those philosophers. And while U.S. and European worldviews are differing more than in the past, they don't require a break in the relationship. It remains grounded in a mesh, if you will, of economic, political, and cultural interests. Moreover, recent evidence is that allies are still willing to provide support on very important matters. Immediately after the September 11th terrorist attacks, NATO invoked its mutual defense clause, and not too much later, NATO members matched words with deeds by offering troops for the Afghan campaign. But that was now more than a year ago, And since then, I would submit, relations have seriously deteriorated. Major differences have arisen about whether to force a regime change in Iraq and how to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. U.S. actions, perceived by Europeans as unilateralists, have also inflamed European opinion, specifically the rejection of international treaties, the penchant for go-it-alone military actions, and the public incorporation of preemption into new security guidelines. The most recent blow to the transatlantic relationship actually stems from within Europe. Just days before September elections, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder barred participation of German troops in any military action against Iraq, even if approved by a UN vote and supported by other NATO members. This position was taken without warning, consultation, or indication that such German participation would be requested. Schroeder's declaration proved sufficiently popular in Germany to assure his victory in a close contest. The apparent appeal of anti-Americanism also caught the fancy of other German political figures. One socialist candidate compared President George W. Bush to the imperial-minded Julius Caesar. A foreign ministry official characterized the new U.S. strategic doctrine as being reminiscent of the Brezhnev doctrine. And an SPD, that's Schroeder's party, an SDP party leader likened the American ambassador to a past Soviet special representative to East Germany. And since the election, while he's tempered his rhetoric a bit, Schroeder continues to talk of the new German way in which decisions will be made in Berlin and only in Berlin. Some of you may have seen it. Henry Kissinger recently voiced deep concern about this if it were to become a trend in Germany. In a Washington Post comment last week, he wrote, "Germany, located in the center of the continent, cannot afford a foreign policy that makes no allowance for the views of other societies, and especially of close allies. If it can affront the United States, reject UN views, and act without consultation with the other nations of Europe, self-righteous isolation beckons for Germany and a return to pre-World War I conditions to Europe." Germany may reflect resentments felt elsewhere in Europe, but its decision to opt out, so to speak, is not yet being imitated. Governments in Italy, Spain, and a number of Central European countries have pledged support for an attack on Iraq if the United States abides by a resumption of UN weapons inspections, with military action only contingent on their failure. Well, after some arduous negotiations stretch over 8 weeks now, the Bush administration has agreed to stay within that UN process. And I think the administration can take some considerable credit for the enabling resolution, which is expected to be passed this week. It is tougher than its predecessor. I think the administration's marshaling of credible threats and forward-positioned troops stiffen the spine of the Security Council and dissolve the resistance of Saddam Hussein, at least initially. Ironically, then, by threatening war, America has fathered the only scenario that may avoid war but still achieve Iraqi disarmament. However, on the road to reconstituting UN inspections, the Bush administration alarmed many here and certainly in Europe with its threats to oust Hussein unilaterally if necessary. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman wrote this past Sunday that German anti-Americanism, already prevalent, was further inflamed by Vice President Cheney's August speech. In that speech, Cheney dismissed UN inspections of Iraq as useless and threatened America may have to act alone. Friedman quoted a leading Christian Democrat's opinion that the Cheney address had a decisive impact on the German elections. If the German government's catering to isolationist public sentiment is unsettling, I think now so is the perpetuation of America's peak. The German election is 2 months past, and still the White House continues to turn a cold shoulder to Schroeder. Bush declined to telephone the chancellor or to respond to two letters from him. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld avoided his German counterpart at a recent NATO meeting, and German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer was denied a White House visit on his recent reconciliation trip to the United States. On that last point, it's worth keeping in mind that Joschka Fischer has proven himself to be one of the more pro-American European politicians on the left. President Bush's distemper, I think, has now been amply conveyed. I think it was deserved in some part. As I say, he was not consulted or given any advance notice of Schroeder's last-minute political maneuverings. But I think it's time to move on. There are many important matters that could be addressed, even while efforts go forward to lessen the serious differences that we now have with Germany about security. Were Bush to keep Europe's strongest country in the doghouse, he would indeed be downgrading the transatlantic relationship. Many observers here and abroad have seized upon the issuance this fall of a new strategic strategy as confirming American hubris and bellicosity. Such impressions, I think, were strengthened by a number of misleading press accounts, some panicky headlines, and usage of a few catchy labels like rogue superpower. Well, now, officially known as the National Security Strategy and required annually by Congress, the document in question is the executive branch's assessment of major international security challenges and what they think can be done about it. Surprise and alarm, I think, greeted this year's version in part because of its frankness and its blunt style and its accessibility to an average reader, which is not common with these kinds of documents. The substance, however, was really not that new. Many of the main points were previewed in President Bush's speech at West Point in June. And the most eye-catching of the recommendations mirrored those that first surfaced in a 1992 Pentagon defense planning guidance, which was drafted by Paul Wolfowitz, who is now the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Often ignored in the commentary on this new security strategy is the emphasis that it places on a kind of multilateralism. The Bush strategy looks to cooperation with great powers as the way to secure a stable international order. Now, you might say in this particular era there are no great powers except one. Well, there are some which are still pretty fulsome, and they are on the rise. In fact, I think that Bush's recognition of other potential power centers is anticipating the rise of large countries, most of them, for the first time, non-Western in terms of the power they're going to have. And that is going to require a different kind of international order than we have had. Another underappreciated characteristic of the strategy is its clear linkage of power and principle. Freedom, individual rights, and democracy are stated out as objectives, not only for their own good, but also as ultimate antidotes to terrorism. The real lightning rod, however, in this document is the concept of preemption. Heretofore, the idea that a nation has the right to thwart an imminent threat has been assumed, but usually left unspoken. So you might ask, why go public now? It's just my thinking, but I think the answer may lie in the nature of international terrorism. It strikes without notice or perceivable buildup, unless intelligence agencies get lucky and correctly interpret very disparate leads. So preemption and prevention are the only protection. And frightened citizens need to know that the United States will not shy from using these remedies. In fact, we used one of them yesterday in Yemen. I think also that the thinking is that if you give notice, You may even stop some terrorist activity from going forward. Now, if a ready resort to preemption was a displacement of containment and deterrence in whole, I think that would be cause for alarm, and so would many others. But this also has been overlooked, that the strategic doctrine I'm talking about characterizes preemption quite clearly as a last resort to be used after diplomacy has failed and only applicable in a few extreme cases, which can, I think, be translated into cases of terrorist subgroups and the like. And it specifically preserves the idea of containment and deterrence as being applicable, probably in most state-to-state contests where we once again find ourselves in serious disagreement with someone. It is less clear, however, on another category, and that is tyrannical states. The strategy says that they, too, may be targets for preemptive action and that they should be considered intellectually in tandem with sub-state terrorist organizations, even when there are no provable links. Now, the argument is twofold, and it kind of goes like this. Authoritarian regimes breed terrorists who strike elsewhere because they are repressed at home. So they're part of the problem, those repressive regimes. Secondly, repressive regimes can extend their reach through terrorists, while terrorists are getting the benefit of training bases, arms, and havens from the tyrannical regimes. Once again, so the two are in the same pot. The security strategy does bring front and center the issue of hegemony, and it is unnerving for many. The strategy states as clear as you can that the United States is going to do whatever it takes, that means spending a lot of money over at the Pentagon, whatever it takes to remain the unrivaled military power in the world. Other countries ought to forsake matching efforts and use their resources more fruitfully on domestic and regional challenges at a lower level. While it is hard to wax enthusiastic about hegemony, it may be worth considering for a moment that in some historical eras, it is better than the alternatives for preserving order and extending liberal values. If we, for example, are in an era where international regimes and law are not yet developed fulsomely enough to really control things, and there really is no multipolar world yet of great, so you can have a concert of great powers, then maybe hegemony is better than too much chaos. But if so, then style becomes vitally important, because to avoid driving envious states into coalitions of opposition, a hegemon must produce benefits for others as well as for itself, and it must limit its intimidation to selective and justifiable cases. A colleague of mine, not at my shop, but in a similar kind of NGO think tank, recently was asked his advice by a high Bush administration official. And knowing that a 30-second reply was all that was really expected, he said, to the question of what should American foreign policy be, he said, America should conduct itself as a benign great power. The official wasted no time to retort, we are a tough great power. Therein may lie some of the problems that we are now beginning to see. But perhaps, to be maybe overly generous, both qualities can be pursued, tough tactics, but benign intents. Certainly the effort ought to be made, because some of the trouble in the transatlantic relationship is clearly attributable to an unnecessary brusqueness of style by the United States. Concerning the lengthy list of international agreements that we find faulty, the United States has been too given to blunt rejection and not enough to searching for compromises or alternatives, solutions. An inescapable cause of resentment in the transatlantic relationship is the large and widening gap in military capabilities. It's there. It's the elephant right in front of us. The combined military assets of European nations do not come close to America's resources in smart weaponry, battlefield technology, special forces, and forward projection lift capacity. These are all the elements of really modern fighting. And furthermore, as time goes by, we are spending more on these things, and Europe is falling further behind. If there is one clear test for European nations who value the transatlantic relationship, it is to step up their contributions to military capabilities. Their small defense budgets represent an absence of will, much more than an absence of resources. The combined GDP of European nations can more than afford ample spending on a rapid reaction force, logistical heft, and technology. Joschka Fischer summarizes the task this way. He's a man of some wit. Figuratively, he said, the United States can be compared to a watermelon. A politically fully integrated Europe, however, can grow to the size of a honeydew melon. Well, I would submit that that would be enough to be a useful security partner. Nobody expects Europe combined or otherwise, or frankly anyone else, to match us. And if we go back to what I said about the doctrine, we're going to make sure they don't anyway. But a heftier force would certainly be useful, one that is modernized. And if European states fail to modernize their militaries, then they can expect, I think, no full participation in battlefield action. Washing the dishes, the disparaging description of post-conflict cleanup and policing will likely be their continuing assignment. Winning priority seating at the security table requires a change of attitude as well as more spending. Europeans will have to link their own sense of safety and well-being to more developments that are occurring elsewhere. They already do to some degree, and they would never be expected to match America's focus on global challenges. Their current preoccupation, perhaps understandably, is on the enormous tasks of completing the peaceful integration of their continent. But as the Chancellor mentioned, by the end of 2004, 10 new members should be in the European Union, and a new constitution should be in place. At that point, if it can't happen sooner, Europe should turn its attention to handling problems beyond its border if it wants a close global relationship with the United States. The last fissure, so to speak, in the transatlantic relationship I wanted to mention is one of an issue, and a very contemporary one and a fractious one. It's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is fostering a most emotional divide within the transatlantic community. Angry Americans think Europeans are insensitive to the violence and uncertainty that mark Israeli life, and that they are too ready to believe the good intentions of Palestinian officials without much having been shown on the tabletop, so to speak. In sharp contrast, the Bush administration has concluded that the Palestinian Authority, marked by inefficiency, corruption, and weakness, is now a stumbling block to credible negotiations and needs to be replaced before things can go forward. For their part, again, Europeans accuse the United States of uncritically supporting Israel and uncaringly disregarding the plight of Palestinians. They decry the absence of energetic efforts to bring the parties to a settlement. Peace conference proposals from the British government, recent ones, and the European Union are generating little enthusiasm from either the U.S. or the Israeli governments. Now, usually it is Americans who are characterized as being ahistorical. But on this issue, I think the shoe fits Europeans. They assume the United States has the leverage to impose a just settlement that would stick, even though both adversaries were opposed to the terms. Now, I think the limits of leverage have been painfully proved over 50 years of diplomats devising formulas, shuttling between the parties, and conferencing in far-off cities and resorts. Just last month, the latest U.S. proposal calling for dozens of concessions in a series of stages leading to a Palestinian state by 2005, received a very cool reception by both the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority. So maybe after President Clinton's Camp David sponsorship failed, U.S. reluctance to wade in again ought to be somewhat understandable. Evidence of some willingness to settle is needed. And absent it, the United States considers that dealing with the Iraqi problem is more pressing. Furthermore, the Bush administration thinks that getting rid of Hussein will improve the prospects for an Israeli-Palestinian settlement. Many Europeans turn that reasoning on its head. Feeling no urgency for a showdown with Hussein, they want to focus on settling the Israeli-Palestinian conflicts. But experience may tell us that seeing the road to Baghdad coming, being the road to a settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, has perhaps some historical precedence. It was the Gulf War in 1991 that cleared the space for the Madrid Conference and for the Oslo peace process itself. Now, prospects are worse today, no question about it. Still, our current government thinks that the road to a two-state solution, if any exists at all, does indeed run through Baghdad. Last comment on this. The emotional aspect of this issue makes it, I think, considerably immune to explanations and arguments and to any agreement of outlook anytime soon. If that is the case, that it remains a divisive element of the first order in our relations across the Atlantic, I think it should be treated most gingerly to avoid too much infection of the relationship itself. I've touched on only some of them, but the tensions affecting the transatlantic relationship come from a number of different categories. Some are institutional, like the military question. Others are cultural, like our death penalty. And some are matters of style, how we treat each other, with condescension or with real respect, with listening or with just giving orders. And no question about it, some of it relies on different worldviews, because particularly since the end of the Cold War, we do indeed have different positions in this world. The differences that exist, therefore, I think, quite clearly stretch across a broad span. They are serious, but I, for one, don't believe that they are unbridgeable, as Kagan would have it. They will require concerted attention from all parties. As in past crises in the relationship, the will to stand together will come from a mutual recognition that anything less will be a loss for all. Together, the Atlantic partners can manage the problems of globalization and terrorism. At least they can manage them better together than either one can on its own. Thank you very much.
The editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, James Hoag. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Next, we hear from university professor and professor of history, David Fromkin. Professor Fromkin is the author of six books, including A Peace to End All Peace and The Way of the World, From the Dawn of Civilization to the Eve of the 21st Century. David Fromkin.
James Hoag, with his superfine journalist's sense of what's going on and his great editor's sense of what's important, has picked, I think, the right subject tonight, something that's not in the headlines, something that's long-term, something that's very important. When I was in my early 20s, I lived in Europe for 3 years, and I have spent some time every summer in Europe ever since. And one of the things I've felt strongly, and it's something that Jim alluded to at the end of his talk, is that many of the issues that we talk about that seem to separate us from our European friends and allies are mere expressions of some other thing, some more underlying difference, some more underlying feelings. As you will see as I go on, this is very much an American's point of view, but an awful lot of the hostility that my friends have encountered and I've encountered over the years have been due to jealousy. I mean, Europeans not wanting us to be the most powerful in the world. They used to be, and they think they have the right to be. It's combined with a frustration that they feel about the pervasiveness of our pop culture, that the by and large people in France, given a choice, will go to a Hollywood movie rather than a French movie, even though, and I agree with them here, even though the French movie is culturally superior. There's a sense of injustice that one encounters, people of great culture, civilization, and accomplishment should be less well-positioned in the world than the United States is. There is, besides that, other issue kinds of things. The left has attacked us for being imperialistic. The right has attacked us, particularly in England, for having helped take their empire away from them. I haven't read the Kagan piece, perhaps it's unfair to comment on it, but I think this isn't a recent thing that we're talking about. When Americans arrived at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, greeted with wild enthusiasm, because the French government expected that we were there to help enforce their terms on Germany. And then they learned that the object of our president, or proclaimed object, was not that. It wasn't to enforce terms on one side on behalf of another. He was there to make what he thought was a fair peace. He was there, he thought, to establish world peace by being just to everybody. And that wasn't what was wanted. And the American delegates to the Paris conference wrote about the tremendous turn in sentiment and the violent anti-American sentiment they felt throughout Paris at that time. In the Second World War, we developed a sense that the Europeans lacked backbone, lacked the nerve to fight for the things we all believed in. If you read Franklin Roosevelt's comments to his intimates and such in June of 1940, he was truly scathing about the French, and afterwards, as we propped up Europe against the Soviet threat, again we've always made the point that they don't contribute enough. Of course, in view of what Jim Hoge has told us about our government's current strategy doctrine, I suppose if I were a European, I'd wonder why I should contribute. Anyway, I mean, why contribute to the gap? If somebody else is the hegemon, somebody else is running things, let them pay for the whole thing. Why not? What has developed, I think, that's especially dangerous now, however, is a different kind of issue than we have encountered before, to this extent. Maybe the first of such things was the campaign for nuclear disarmament in Great Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, a kind of issue in which people in Europe, those certainly who subscribe to the to those views, they had a feeling that we didn't share. That's the worldview thing, I think, perhaps, that Mr. Kagan's talking about, that we didn't share their sense of right and wrong. In a sense, it's like the appearance of the abortion issue in American domestic politics 30 years ago. I mean, suddenly the intrusion of a social issue, not a political issue, one didn't perceive it as that at first, but a social issue that is turned out to be much more immensely divisive much more a thing that pulled at emotions and so on than any of the more routine and ordinary political issues did. And the thing that struck me, then I'm going to turn this back over to Jim for questions. The thing that struck me this summer, two things. My friends who live in Europe again and again said to me, David, do you have any idea how deep the anti-American feeling is now? Like nothing we felt before. Truly deep. And the other thing, to my astonishment, was the issue, and Jim, great journalist that he's onto it, the issue they all mentioned was the death penalty. And they weren't talking about our policy towards Iraq or even our policy with regard to Israel and the Arabs, though that important though that is. That made them, the death penalty thing was something that made many Europeans feel we are not part of them. We are not like them. We speak of Western civilization, but I think many people in Europe are of the view that they're it and we're not. Because of these kinds of things. So it is important to heal the rift in the Atlantic Alliance. But how do we do it when these deep underlying conflicts are there and not just the specific policy issues that we have to get resolved?
University Professor David Fromkin. Following the Fromkin response, James Hogue answered questions from the audience, touching on many topics.
I'm happy to take some questions. On that remark that David just made about the death penalty, Joschka Fischer, as I mentioned, has just been on, quote, a reconciliation trip to the United States, and he saw Powell in Washington but couldn't get into the White House. Came through New York, and a few of us had dinner with him. And in addition to international things, the subject he wanted to talk about most was the American death penalty. So if you think it really isn't, if you think it's something passing, it isn't. They managed to use this now as a real piece of symbolism. I don't want to take anything away from their, I'm sure, heartfelt feelings about the death penalty. That is wrong. Many of us here in America feel that way. But why did it mushroom to this size at this particular time? I think it's a wonderful vehicle, consciously or unconsciously, for diminishing the United States, which otherwise is such an overwhelming presence now with our movies on French screens, with our genes on half the population, and on building up from popular culture right through politics and economics. Well, if you can pick out a few things that says, well, that may be the case, but it really is a very barbaric, uncivilized, uncultured mass society, it might make you feel a little better. So I think that's one reason. Because, frankly, if you look at public opinion polls, as the crime rates are rising in Europe, and they are, particularly in those that now have very large Muslim minorities, public approval of having a death penalty is rising. And governments are set against it, and I don't think it's coming. But the idea that all of Europe thinks this is shocking and is not a possible tool to bring a crime rate down, that just isn't the case. So if you go below, if you go down to public levels, once again, like on so many other big kind of cultural issues, there isn't that much difference between Europe and the United States. You do a public opinion poll here on the death penalty, and there'll be a very high percentage of Americans who say, I think we've now proved that this isn't workable. This isn't fair. We can't do it right. So, enough said. Yes, there would still be anti-Americanism, as there was before this administration. During the Clinton years, there was quite a bit. And there were references then to our, quote, unilateralist tendencies and our unwillingness to consult and so forth and so on. But having said that, you're on to something which I think is necessary for this night's discussion. I didn't have time for everything. And that is that you can hold two ideas at the same time in your mind. And throughout Europe, there is still a good deal of respect for the United States, for our higher values of democracy, individual rights, and so on. There was great sentiment for us after September 11th. I'm sad to say a lot of it, however, has dissipated a great deal. after the Afghan campaign, the bombings, the threats, and so on. Still in all, sometimes we can be misled by the political or intellectual leadership in societies. French intellectuals, for example, have been tearing at our hide for generations. There's nothing new, although it's gotten really pretty rough. And below that, you can travel to France and people will be as nice to you as the French ever are to anybody who's not French. I would agree that the particular behavior of the current administration has added an edge, but I would not say that they have created this anti-Americanism. It was there, it was flourishing on its own, and some of it is unavoidable. When you're number one as clearly as we are, others are going to envy you, are going to resent you, and are going to want to question your policies and your actions a great deal. I'd also add this thought real quickly. On the international front, I think the Bush administration, like many that have preceded it, is making adjustments for the reality they are discovering, i.e. you can come into office, particularly in America, where you may come from Texas or Arkansas, and while you're very, very smart, you haven't been that much overseas, you come in and you learn that everything you want to do the way you want to do it just isn't doable that way. It's no accident that we're in the UN process. And Powell gets a lot of credit, but let me tell you who gets the most credit from the reporting I've done, and that's Blair. I am told that it is Tony Blair who persuaded more than anybody else Bush that he had to go that route. And being a very good politician, Blair not only referred to the morality of it and the international legitimacy of it, but he pointed out to Bush what his own public opinion polls at home here in the United States were beginning to show, which was pretty solid backing for doing something about Iraq, as long as we do it, quote, the politically correct way, with a UN mandate, with allies agreeing to whatever the action is, and that it just plummets the moment you take away those fig leaves, if you will, or those safeguards, and do it all on your own. Although his politics are different, he shares an attitude, if you will, with Bush, and that is that morality is a big deal and that it should infuse politics and policy. And he uses the word, it's the moral thing to do an awful lot. You know, his nickname is the preacher. So that's one reason. A second reason, I think, has to do with the position Great Britain finds itself in now. It's got a foot in Europe, but it's not really in. And it's got a special relationship, which isn't quite as special as it once was because they're not as strong as they once were. And since you don't really know which of these is going to work out for you, you want to keep them both going, and you particularly want to keep the American relationship because they know us, I think, intuitively better than the Europeans. Look what just happened to Britain. After we dissed Schroeder, and Schroeder is kind of feeling isolated and alone, he collapsed in front of Chirac's all-court press on agricultural subsidies, and the two of them presented it to the Brits, just like the old German-French axis, take it or leave it. And Blair was furious. So that's a third, that's a second reason. And then I'll give him the benefit of the doubt of what he's saying. A third reason is I think he truly believes Iraq with nuclear weapons is a threat and that the only credible approach is the one the Americans are taking. Now, let me tell you what he's done with that. He has supported us all the way because otherwise you don't really, you're not a member of the kitchen cabinet, you don't get the same hearing. But behind the scenes, Blair and his ambassador to the UN, who's terribly good, Jeremy Greenstock, have been working night and day, both to get the United States within the UN process, then to get it to switch the aim from regime change to disarmament, and then thirdly, to agree that it would not take any action without coming back for some form of consultation, not a second resolution. You haven't heard a word of that publicly because the moment they said that publicly, they'd be in the same position that France is, which is essentially contesting with it when what they want to be is in the tent with us at all times. I think they've had on all three of those issues, I think they've had a major impact. And my hat is off to Blair and Greenstock and Jack Straw for some very clever and, I think, useful international diplomacy with us. So I think I'm expecting more moderate behavior as they go forward than we saw in the first year to year or 2 years. Because of the brusque style of the Bush administration, which is, I think, is leavening some, there was already a lot of nervousness around. What have we got on our hands here? Is it a loose elephant? And so any strategic document coming forward at that particular time, I think, would have been looked on with a little more nervousness than any other time. Secondly, as I mentioned, compared to most national strategic documents, for example, compared to the ones that the Clinton people used to do, this reads like a thriller. Plenty of Americans think the post-conflict stage of Iraq is a huge problem, that we haven't thought it through, and that one of the reasons to go through a UN process and hope that maybe you can get a sufficient disarmament so that he's not the threat that he otherwise might be, is that we really don't know what it would be like afterwards, not only in the country but in the region. So I wouldn't I take your point that Europeans are thinking a lot about this. I think many of us are as well. So I'm not sure that that's a clear distinction between us Roman legions and their Greek poets. Well, within the Bush administration, I mean, one of the fascinating things we've had for the last 18 months is this battle royal going on within the Bush administration, but not between Bush and the Democrats, over whether to have a war or not, and whether to have one strictly on our own terms or through some international procedure. They've also had a hell of a war about what to do afterwards. You have kind of the neocon school that thinks the real reason to go to war in Iraq is that it is the first break in the string of autocratic governments that are throughout the Middle East, and until you begin to topple them over, it's never going to be anything but a very dangerous region. So why don't we get started? And the place to start is Iraq. Now, this is very grand thinking. And when you start trying to make it specific, okay, well, then what comes after? Do we take on Iran, or is there a different strategy for Saudi Arabia? It begins to fall apart in a fog bag. There is that kind of thinking. Then there is the thinking to know we need to go in and make a democracy, which is a 10- or 15-year multi-billion-dollar, and then let that example help everybody else. And then the third, the Rumsfeldian view is, look, we're not everybody's a nanny. They're a menace to us right now. We're going to go in and take the menace out by knocking his head off, by taking away all the weapons. And then it'll be up to the Iraqis to get sensible about coming up with a better way to live, a better society, a better government, and so on. And, yeah, we'll give them a few bucks, and maybe we'll have a few soldiers around for a couple of months, but that's about it. Take, for example, the way we talk about China today. Well, when they came into office, China was being relabeled not a strategic partner, but a strategic competitor. One of the problems is these guys came into office, they were fueled by such anti-Clinton hatred that they went overboard in doing everything to show that we're not Clinton and to kind of dispense with whatever he had been doing. When they came into office, they said, who needs to worry about Russia? It's got an economy smaller than Denmark. It's a third-rate developing country and will be for the next 100 years. You know, they'll no longer be considered a great power. We have turned around dramatically on that because even though those facts are correct, this great landmass sitting at least with half of it in Europe cannot be ignored. And the other half has this huge border in Central Asia with some of the most questionable countries and some of the most delicate stability problems in the globe. So the council and the magazine it founded separately, Foreign Affairs, were both set up to be forums. We do not take positions. We do not have political alliances. We take no government money. So it is meant to be a contributing institution on two things. One, public education of at least the attentive public, and two, policy debate and discussion to see if better policies can come from that process. Now, as to who we get along with, we are reaching out more and more to do things in collaboration with like-minded institutions like the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, some on the West Coast, and overseas. We also now have a London branch of our own with council members. I think we get along very well with like-minded institutions, Chatham House in Great Britain, IFRI in Paris. But I must tell you that for the most part, we operate on a somewhat different level. We're bigger, and here's the American story again. We're a bigger and richer institution than they are, and we have a lot more going on. We have 75 fellows, plus a big meetings program, plus a policy task forces being convened all the time. Your last question was, are we getting along with folks better than we did a few years ago, which seems to imply that maybe we get along better with conservatives and liberals or with Republicans and Democrats. Our situation is this. Most conservatives think that we are a voice of liberalism. Most liberals think we are a voice of conservatism. And we try not to be either. The only label I think you can pin on the council on an ongoing basis and on the magazine is that we are internationalists. We do believe that the United States has to play a role in the world and that if it's equipped right, it can play a better role than it otherwise would. The council was founded in 1921 after World War I by some returning American veterans who also happened to be kind of East Coast establishment people with this primary thought in mind. America is too ignorant. It gets involved too easily in things it doesn't know anything about. And it also now has a role to play in the world that it cannot avoid, but that it won't play that role and it won't play it very well if there isn't more public education, if there isn't more real consideration of policy options.
James Hogue. You've been listening to the Institute for Human Sciences inaugural lecture, featuring the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, James Hogue, and a response from University Professor David Fromkin. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth, with help from Keith Infantino and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.